Welcome to Pat's Labor, a podcast about the anime Pat Labor and Pat's labor to learn about labor history through the prism of Pat Labor. I'm Clayton Ashley.
I'm Tucson Egan.
And I'm Pat Labor. We did it.
That's
Yay!
A wrap.
Yay! We did it! We finally did it. It only took four episodes, technically five, because we also have like our zero episode, but like that was before we decided on like what our opening was going to be. But I'm so proud of us
that we'd make our opening a tongue twister on purpose.
Absolutely.
And it'll never ever be hard again.
Nope. Ever.
Once you've done it once.
Hi everybody, how's everybody's week going?
It's going good. Just doing chores, reading books. You know,
all right, let's go real quick. Adult. Everybody's favorite and least favorite chore.
Interesting. Sweeping, I enjoy.
Sweeping feels good.
It's not especially like dirty or icky, but it does make a difference, and it's a little meditative.
My favorite chore is folding my laundry, because the laundry is already done. The laundry is already done, and it's warm. And then I get taken out of the dryer, and then I just fold my shirts all nicely and put them away. And then I can just be like, oh, I like this shirt. And I was like, oh, I've been looking for this shirt. And I was like, oh, yeah. Like, that's what I enjoy.
I love the I've been looking for this shirt moment. I love it. I love it when you find a shirt that you stopped looking for.
Yes. And then you find, like, where the fuck has this been? Like, yo, what's going on? My least
favorite.
It's
been pushed. It's been pushed through your drawers underneath and somehow got caught
into the nether realm. I hate that place.
It's
bad.
My least favorite is going through mail and opening
sucks, dude.
Opening like junk mail. I did a lot of like, we had like just a pile of junk mail that we never went through, and I'm just like, well, I guess it's time for me to finally go for this junk mail. And that was my whole fucking weekend, just going through junk mail.
Do you get a lot of like return to send or stuff? It's, you know, old address, so you're trying to do return to sender.
Yeah, there's a lot of old address shit. And then there's a lot of like, you know, credit cards and like other stupid bullshit. And then once in a while, like you'll get like a thing that's actually like important. And so it was like this small pile of important things next to a colossal pile of just junk mail. But I got a paper shredder now. That's a lot of fun.
That's fun. That really makes
that
it more
is fun.
Fun.
Yeah, it is.
I enjoy loading the dishwasher.
Oh, that's a good
And chore. That's a new one for me because we didn't have a dishwasher before we moved out here.
That's even better because you know what it's like to not have a dishwasher. Everybody hates doing the fucking dishes, but dishwasher, like, yeah, that's perfect. Yeah.
I used to like washing the dishes, but I hated drying the dishes. I would like the warmth on my hands. It felt nice to have the warmth on my hands when I was running that hot tap over my my hands. And speaking of hot water, that's our characters spend some time in a hot spring in this episode of Pat Labor.
They're also in some hot water.
I was going to say
that's true.
They're literally in some hot water.
Yeah.
Yeah, why don't you lead us in? What was the first, was the instigating action of this episode?
Yeah.
It was pretty great.
This week, we watched the fourth episode of Mobile Police Pat Labor, The Early Days, Episode 4, The Tragedy of L. And this episode starts off in Tokyo with a hostage situation where two men have taken a third man hostage, and they are being absolutely dressed down by the most aggressive hostage negotiator I have ever heard. He's just pretty much calling them
I was going to say the worst hostage negotiator like I've ever heard.
Yeah, and they've brought out one of the hostage taker's mothers to yell at him, and it's a funny reversal of the idea of like bringing out the victim's mother to plead. It's like, no, we're going to bring out like the assailant's mother, and she's going to tell you to knock this shit off. So we have a very, very tense hostage situation. And
where is the hostage situation taking place at, though? It's in a it is a VHS rental store, and behind, like, there's a close up of the kidnappers and the hostage, right? And you can see over their shoulder that there's a VHS, which appears to be Pat Labor.
Like in, it's definitely, in the background. That's definitely a mecha head.
Is like it's got the same rabbit ears. It looks like the Pat Labor that they just have like in the VHS store. But yes, continue. Yeah.
Well, it's fun because that's the first little like tip off that this episode's going to acknowledge the existence of mecha media, which
yes,
is very interesting.
Like, I love it. Yes.
Yeah, we'll, foreshadowing.
Yeah, we'll get there. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But Oda, who is, if you don't remember, Oda is our member of the second division, who is the really hot-headed, trigger-happy one who always wants violence and conflict. Mm-hmm. And he is absolutely freaking out, chomping at the bit, wanting to get at these hostage takers. And what and the situation ends when he loses his cool, charges in, sticks his gun through the window of the building and pulls the trigger, which when the gigantic robot revolver goes off, it blows the roof off the building.
I was trying to figure, somebody said like, team two, SV2, you have authorization to shoot. I thought somebody said that.
No, it was Goto was like, you have authorization to like move up or something like that. Like Goto says, like, you can move in if you want to. And then Oda just sort of like broke rank and just like...
He doesn't just pull his gun up. He literally like shoves his gun and they're against the back wall of the video rental store and then shoots a bullet the size of a watermelon. So we don't see the result of that. I feel like it's a little glazed over, but they're very dead, right? Like,
No, I don't think they are. It was a blank. It was a blank. And like, it was the hostage takers and the hostage that were, that were cowering in like in the scope of the barrel. They were all cowering together and it just exploded the entire like second floor and the first floor of the VHS building.
Okay. So how did I miss that? When they say it was a blank or...
It was a blank.
Yeah. It was the next scene where like they're all standing back at the SV headquarters and Goda is just like, it doesn't matter that it was a blank, okay?
Oh,
they're
good.
Still
okay.
Really mad about this. It's like, and here's like, I gotta read this quote because this is what I think you were teeing
up. Because I was way too focused on the rest of this dressing down and I missed that. Yeah.
Yes. He's like, and so Goda is like, you're public servants, people. Public servants. What do you think you're piloting? Great Mazinger or Dangayo? For Pete's sake, this isn't some robot cartoon whose main character is an autistic kid or some punk. Don't you get it? I was just like, yo!
Oh, man, this week, I was like, I had to go back and listen to that because I was like, did they say an artistic kid?
No,
like,
no, they said an autistic kid.
And I would like to issue a correction. This show is about a bunch of autistic kids piloting mechs.
They're all just grown-ass kids. That's really what it is. It's like, so for those who don't know, Great Mazinger is a 1972 manga-turned-anime that was created by Go Nagai, who you may recognize as the mangaka behind such titles as Cutie Honey and perhaps best known for Devilman. There's also Dangayo, which was directed by Toshiki Hirano, and the mecha was designed by Shoji Kawamori, and you may recognize those names for the fact that the former was the chief character animator and the latter was the chief mecha designer for Super Dimension Fortress Macross, which is one of the holy triumvirate of real anime.
He went a little more niche here. He could have said Gundam and Macross, but he's like Mazinger.
No. And the whole autistic kid thing, I'm just like, that feels like a I know this show was made in 1988, but it feels like I immediately thought of Evangelion for some reason. Evangelion,
right.
I was just like,
it's like maybe, a called shot. It's maybe, wild.
Right. I'm just like, damn. Okay. Like, shit.
The plot point of it being a blank.
Yeah.
Of it being a blank in the chamber was, it is in fact another instance of Pat Labor, like, safety obsession and bureaucracy, because the first round and the thing is a blank to be more or less to make sure that when they start shooting that there's less chance that somebody gets hurt, I guess.
Right.
I don't understand
like
really why they
one chance for
be.
A misfire in a way. It's like one chance to like get a little hot-headed and thank goodness. Yeah. Like, what was the last part of this like dressing down? Which, it, like, frankly, it's not like that harsh in a way. It's kind of funny the way it's just, you know, reminding them what their job is. And then he's like, you're all heading back to Fuji. Noah, she knows what this is about. because that's where she went to train. It's a training facility for Pat Labor pilots.
That's also where Asuma train. And it's funny because, like, when Gota tells them that they've been, like, put on the bench and, like, they've been disbanded, everybody cheers with the exception right. of one person, and that's Kanuka Clancy because she's a professional. Like, she's an actual professional.
They're like, summer vacation!
Quick character recap for Kanuka Clancy. She is the character who is American, Hawaiian, mixed race descent, speaks English and Japanese, has recently got a temporary reassignment to this unit from the NYPD.
LA branch.
And she is really good in this episode and is incredibly competent and rules. Yeah. But that's her main thing is just like being competent and very good at what she does. So this episode kicks off with the hostage situation gag, which is all to get us to the academy where our characters need to be retrained following this shooting incident. So our characters are hanging out. We almost immediately get into the bathhouse content, and it looks like it's going to be a pervy bathhouse situation where the boys decide that they're going to sneak over and see what the girls are up to.
I was going to mention this. It was like, there's actually like one joke that I wanted to mention before this, where it's like they get there, they travel to Fuji after like accidentally like the Pat Labor transport ends up in a ditch. In a muddy ditch while they're on their way there because it's raining so hard. They finally get there.
And they only brought the Pat Labor to be like to impress the other cadets. Like,
right.
There wasn't really a reason to bring it.
Yeah. And Noah is like, they have a guy here who looks just like the captain. And Gota is like, I am the captain. And just, I'm here to. There's a lot of really good humor and like good jokes here,
just jokes, like well-written jokes, because it's just you're just seeing Izumi saying like I think talking to Noah and she's just like, there's a man here who looks a lot like your captain, and then just cut to Goto standing there staring at them saying, I am your captain,
right?
So funny. Yeah.
it was really good.
And so they go to the bathhouse in order to wash up because they're so muddy and everything, and I think it's Asuma and Shinshi who overhear Noah talking to Captain Nagumo, who is the head of the Special Vehicles Unit 1, which, where the hell are those guys? Like, where
still
are,
haven't seen them.
I have no idea.
That's
where
such
they
such a good
where,
running joke, honestly.
I feel like if we were watching the anime about them, we'd be watching a anime that was less interesting to us. It would be good, but it would not be Pat Labor
they are hyper competent and they're taking on like the big crimes or whatever. It would be like Ghost in the Shell standalone complex, only without the cyberpunk and actual mecha and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But like, so they overhear Noah and they get like this mischievous idea and they look over to Yamazaki. And then Yamazaki just like starts shaking his head and they glare at him, and then he's like wrestles like Ota to get him to be quiet or something like that, and like
I think they don't trust Ota to go along with their perversion plans, so they choke Ota out.
It's odd, but and then I don't know why I typecast him as the one who'd be into it.
And then Shinshi is like, I may be happily married, but I'm still a man, which as a man and the fact and as a man as a married man and also like
these I clocked her, him early on as a wife
he's,
guy.
These, nope. Yeah, he's a wife guy, a wife who literally delivers your underwear in the dead of night so that you have something to wear the next morning. Right. Makes your lunch, and like these are your colleagues. I'm like, dude, come on.
And this
on.
Isn't even like having a glance at a pretty lady on the street. This is let's sneak into the women's bathhouse.
Or overhear something like that. I disavow and do not condone this chicanery. I was like,
that is a good distinction, Toussaint, is that they do not actually imply that they are going to go over there. They go put their ears up against the wall, and there's no like Porky's hole in the wall. So it could be as simple as they're trying to be nosy and figure out if these ladies are gonna talk about their crushes.
Yeah.
But we hop over to the women's side, and they're talking, and we hear a voice from off screen, which is important. It is the caretaker. He's dropped off their, or he's cleaned their clothes and dropped them off or something.
Mr. Jen. And Kanuka reactively like reaches for her pistol concealed in a like wooden barrel filled with like soaps and towels and stuff like that. She's just like, she's always got that motherfucking thing on her. She is not the one. She is not the one.
Because at first I was like, oh, is she hearing them like being pervy? And then, oh no, it's just the guy. He's dropping off our clothes. No worries. And then she puts the gun back down. And then they hear a shout, a scream, presumably from the men's bathhouse room.
Yes. And this is a great moment really quickly of Kanuka being extremely media competent, which she shows her media literacy later in the episode as well. But I think in this moment, when she cocks that Colt 1911, she knows that she is a female character in an anime in a bathhouse. So she keeps that thing on her. Go on, Clayton.
But this was sick. Because again, not expecting, like, don't know what to expect vis-a-vis like how the show is animated and what its style is.
Dude. But
the scream, then she like jumps into action, grabs the gun and starts running out of this room, which is still kind of a still shot. And then it transitions to a first person
shot. Yes. A tracking shot from her perspective.
It's so interesting to think about this as like, it's animated though. Like this isn't them doing what a lot of modern cartoons, even ones that are kind of technically 2D animation, but they have almost like a ability to animate in a 3D room. And that's like an easier thing to do when you have computers to aid you. But this is hand-drawn cell animation giving us a like running to the next room. Don't know what's going to happen. She slides through the door and has the gun like ready.
But she slides open the door. It shows like the door is empty. Like, who is that? And then it pans down to her on the ground, like ready to just like pop like whoever's there. I was like, yo, she is so cool. She's
so sick.
Yeah.
I love that animation sequence. The first person part, like the actually like her arm coming up with the gun in the hand to ram through the door. It's like clearly totally seeing through her eyes. And it's also a good fix for what could otherwise be a bit of a TV rating situation, because she's butt ass naked when she does this.
Right.
Then Noah immediately shows up and covers her with a towel. So you don't see anything. So we're all good. Within the room, in the men's room, Oda is now floating in a pool of blood.
Or what looks like to be blood.
And weirdly, I forgot, we got like right before it cut to the women's baths, we saw the faucet in the men's room, or presumably the men's room, but because this is the last thing we saw before it transitioned over to the women, and it was a little bit of red was starting to come out of the faucet.
I thought it was blood,
Right, it was weird, but it's kind of like, okay, what does that mean? And it's like, forget about it, we're going to go, you know, talk to these other characters. And so that was like, at least in my mind, and it was just like, how did this happen? How is Goto like dead? And then next scene, and we have Goto there, and these kind of running down. Based on like how chill they all are, I pretty quickly was like, wait, he's not dead. He's not they didn't actually just off a character.
Yeah. They got Yamazaki cowering in the corner too. And I'm just like, you literally had him in a headlock a while ago. So what's going on? I don't think he's dead. He can't be dead. Like,
you're right. Right.
It is immediately revealed that it was paint, but they don't know where it came from or why it was in the bathhouse.
Not just any paint though. The kind of paint commonly found in paintball guns.
Yeah, to which Mr. Sakuma, one of the caretakers of the training facility, seems kind of unnerved by that. Seems kind of terrified,
That's putting it lightly. This is also interesting because he's the only person we've seen who's working here.
Yeah.
It's empty. All the cadets are home for summer vacation. I think they also mentioned here, or maybe they'd already mentioned this at the beginning, why it's so empty. But and then Goto starts kind of like laying down some rules, which is like, okay, I'm going to figure this out, like why this happened. But, you know, someone's pranking us probably. But, you know, don't worry about it. You all have an early morning. We're here to train. No ghost stories and no staying, no leaving the premises. Don't even look out your windows. Keep your windows closed. Like, it's kind of a weird, like, this isn't just college. This is like military college. Like, you know, you all have to follow these rules and get up. Don't think too much about the ghost stories. Hint, hint.
It's because he knows exactly what they're going to do when he tells them not to do it. So we have a great scene of Oda getting up in the middle of the night to get a drink of water. He hears a sound. He hears a woman's voice saying, "Don't shoot, don't shoot." And it freaks him the fuck out. Then he sees a sad-eyed ghostly figure outside the window. Doesn't know what it's about. The same night,
Don't forget, he also he's like washing his hands, and then he picks up his hands and it's full of hair.
Yeah.
And then he sees the lady with long hair outside her window saying, "Don't shoot." So it's very spooky. He is very freaked out.
The rest of the crew sleeping in the room hear a sound, something thumping around outside, and they can identify from the sound of it that it is a labor walking around, and they're not sure who could be up piloting it. And as they peek out the window, they do see a labor walking around on its own outside, covered in moss and vines like the Swamp Thing. And it comes towards the camera. And this was just another piece of really good animation this episode, as the moss sloughs off the front of it. And the thing about the labors is they all have open cockpits. You can always see the pilot in them. You can always see the head of the pilot in them. So the moss sloughs off, and this skeletal pilot in a police uniform lurches forward. And that's the end of that scene. Really good stuff.
Yeah. And for a second, I was like, wait, is this the return of our big primate monster from the last episode?
No.
I had a moment, too, where I was like, do we have a kaiju again?
No.
So, yeah, they pretty much resume training, not knowing what is going on.
Yeah.
Let's not talk about last night.
No.
This is where I took a note. I took a note. We got cicadas.
Yeah.
I did, too. Yep.
We have the classic anime summer cicada sounds looping in the background, being very, very soothing.
I feel like this is just a tease for our bonus episode zero, if anybody wants to grab that. We recorded that back in August, and I really appreciated, actually, that gently rasping in Toussaint's background are Midwest cicadas.
Yeah.
I was like, this is authentic. I'm glad this is here, frankly.
Yes, yeah.
But the other part about this I kind of noted was, like, their training is just, like, running after Godo in his car, while he just, like, kind of, like, marching. It's like 1, 2, 3, 4, that kind of training. So it's pretty classic at this point. I'm kind of like, what does this have to do with Pat Labors at this point? But anyway, Noah and Azuma, they decide at this point, let's skip class. This is boring.
Yeah, Noah and Azuma skip class. They run into the caretaker who is there when Shinohara was training. He seems a little freaked out, and they're asking him what's going on. He doesn't really give them much to go on until
we meet what's her name.
Yes, we meet a woman who looks exactly like the deceased or the ghost who has visited Ota. So now we have a look-alike situation where we have a ghost and a woman who looks like the ghost. My immediate thought is, obviously, that's the lady pretending to be the ghost. But there ends up being a bit of a swerve on that concept, because Shinohara gets the story that a bit after his graduation, there was a mock combat trial there at that very same facility where one of the laborers falls over and its handgun discharges and a young woman is shot and killed. It's a practice round, but it's a practice round that comes out of a gun that's 10 feet long, so it absolutely kills her. And that the pilot of the mech was her older brother.
No.
So still within his labor, he picks her up and walks off into the swamp, never to be seen again. So we have a ghost labor and a ghost girl and a frightening parable about the dangers of gun violence.
What's also really cool about this scene is that Asuma knows this old man. Like he's just, he's met him before or something. I think old relationship. And at first he's like, you tell me what I want to know because like we're buddies. And then he just starts beating him up to get this.
Yeah. It shows a still frame of him, like basically stomping on his nuts to make him like talk.
And it's a technique that is set up earlier in the episode when they're doing it to one of their own friends. I forget which character they're doing it to, but they're in the barracks when it's Shinohara doing it to one of the other Pat Labor cops. He's just like, he's got his like legs up in the air and he's just like jabbing his toes into his nuts.
But what's cool about this is that they are in like current timeline. Clancy and Oda are doing a mock combat battle, and it's a fun, like, it is the rare bit of just sick mecha action that the show has. But while this fight is happening, we're getting this, it's like, I think it's really beautifully done, where he's telling, he's not telling the story, he's like reiterating what the old man told, reiterating what the old man told him. And because that, what happened back then is basically the exact thing that's happening right now, where they're doing a mock fight, it keeps kind of like pivoting between the past and the actual fight currently happening. And then that's almost the point of it, because in the fight that's happening in modern times, Oda gets his shit wrecked, falls over, he's holding a gun, and that gun aims right at all the other pilots.
Right.
It clicks and misfires, so like nothing happens. It's not even like a fake bullet. But then what's our guy, our groundskeeper's name?
Sukuma. Yeah.
And Sukuma's right there, and he's like, it's just like last time! Yeah. And once again runs off frightened.
They have, I think it's Shijio Shiba, who is like the second-in-command chief mechanic, come out to figure out what happened. And he's like, well, somebody like reprogrammed this thing. It's like, because Oda swears, is like, I didn't pull the trigger or anything like that. I immediately let go of it. It pulled the trigger on its own. It's like, how could that have happened? And then he's just like, I don't know who could have like programmed something like this. I could program something like this, but I don't know who else could do that.
Now, I want to say, I think he also had a great, is it him who has this line? Somebody has a really incredible line here that I think is, I didn't realize or wondered how much the show would talk about police stuff that's kind of like relevant outside of how Japan thinks of police. But somebody here says, they're in the setting where we actually find out the second half of this, which is that the brother is the one who killed his sister. And right. It's in this beautiful sort of silhouette, golden sunlight scene. Mm-hmm. It's again,
monochrome money, orange, but it's gorgeous. Scene. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's beautiful. Yeah. And because they're sitting in this classroom as the setting sun comes in the window. So everyone's just like lit up in this perfect orange light.
It's really good. And then I think it's somebody asks, well, wait, if this happened, have we never heard about this? How didn't this get out?
And then Asuma says something to the effect of like, well, Goda and like the other people are like cops to the core. And they're,
I wrote it
like,
down here.
Please. Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
The police have always seen themselves as one big family. So it's hard for them to air their dirty laundry in public. Pretty much everyone there was an interested party. Cops to the core. And I think he specifically refers to their two guys as cops to the core.
Yeah.
So that was, I was just kind of like a little stunned by how much they directly say like, yeah, the police don't rat out each other.
That's why a sci-fi mecha police procedural workplace comedy that critiques the institution of policing as well as like
the thin blue line,
the thin blue line and gun culture. I'm just like, damn, this is that real shit. I like that. Like, it's like, we can have a show that like centers on cops, but like, let's just talk about everything that sort of encompasses that as well within the speculative
from 1988,
like, from 1988. Yeah. Like, yo, this is wild. I love this show. Yeah.
I do love that when Shige finds the thing that caused the trigger to pull, he calls it a ghost. So he says that somebody has reprogrammed the mech to do exactly what it did, and that only he could have done it, or somebody like as skilled as him could have programmed the Pat Labor to do this upon getting knocked over.
But he also knows it was not in this state when it left 2 days ago. So someone had to tamper with it in the intervening days. It's very good how they set this up of like, here's some more clues, adding these little details here and there.
Yeah.
And then our climactic scene is...
Or two of them.
Yeah, a couple of them. We have all of our parties together, all of our characters, every member of the Second Division is together in a classroom. And they're discussing what has been going on. And Shinohara shows up. Him and Noah Izumi put on a bit of a presentation because they are pretty sure they know exactly what is going on. They, after having these conversations, go searching around. They're told of a character called Jen, who had previously been at the academy and is no longer there, but had an interest in computer programming and stuff. So they have recovered from a room a skull mask, a tape with the Don't Shoot recording on it, and a computer programming book.
In Mr. Jin's like locker or something, or his room.
Right, his room. Yeah, they search his room. And they give a speech about how they're pretty sure whatever's happening here is absolutely not a ghost story, but it is an attempt by somebody to teach them a lesson about the dangers of using guns.
I wrote this down. I wrote this whole thing that Asuma said down.
Please, yes.
Okay, so it's like, up until 50 years ago, Japanese police weren't armed. I won't reiterate the rules of their handling here, but I think this incident is to make us rethink what guns are for, as well as to make us reflect on our actions, because guns or not, our actions can have grave consequences. And so I actually backtracked this. This is just like, if this takes place in a speculative 1998, 50 years prior to that would be 1948. And I looked this up. Japanese police began to be armed with guns after World War II, with all officers issued handguns by 1951, though the sourcing of these firearms was initially through leases from the Allies due to insufficient domestic supply. So it's like, there's a whole, it's actually like hearkening to real life history and real life contextualization about like societal like gun ownership and what does it mean to actually like possess a firearm and what does it mean to have like,
How should armed agents of the state act in?
Yes. Yeah, I'm like, this is so lit. This is so good. Yes.
The preoccupation that this entire show has had with firearms and guns, this episode is just like a wonderful, funny and fun culmination of it. To your point, Toussaint, it was specifically Allied Supreme Commander MacArthur
who I've wondered.
Told the Japanese government, like, hey, your cops need to start carrying guns. Prior to that, they, you know, Japanese police would use force, right? They had batons and they had sabers and stuff, but gun is a big upgrade from that, especially considering how long law enforcement had been carrying weapons in the United States before then. So this is the gun, the policeman holding a gun is very much a symbol of occupation to the Japanese people. And so like, it feels to me like this is like a slight soapbox moment for Oshi to be like, hey, this is kind of fucked up that we're even having to consider the power and danger of these things when it wasn't really even our idea. But I'm not inside his head.
And so we but they're here now. So we have to have that conversation. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the whole thing here about, you know, you could even look at the Pat Labors as kind of that metaphor of, well, the criminals, you know, they have pistols, so we get pistols. Well, now they have Uzis, and now we need Uzis. And now they have assault weapons, and we need assault weapons. Like,
he said that, too, where it's just like, yeah, this is meant to, like, have us think about if it weren't for the guns, and moreover, if it weren't for the Pat Labor, this thing would not have happened. This tragedy would not have happened.
You're right, they literally say that.
Yeah.
But I guess this all seems so wrapped up neatly. I guess this is just a parable about, you know, how powerful guns are.
It's a critique of the escalation of force. But one more thing, yes.
This is the moment where I did kind of fall in love with Kanuka Clancy. Obviously, like, she is a very lovable character, right? She's a cute, extremely competent, funny character.
Yeah.
Badass character. But she won more things than... and undercuts them and says, that's all very good. None of this stuff happened.
And Mr. Jin, I was going to try to write down exist.
Yes. I wanted to write down like a quote from her speech, but the entire speech was just so good. So people just have to watch this episode, but she just delivers an incredible monologue about the importance of examining evidence that you are given and, you know, what kind of trust you put into evidence and who you get it from and how that all matters really much. And how you, if you follow the clues that are left for you, you often arrive at conclusions that other people want you to arrive at.
This isn't just a speech about policing. This is like how to be like a responsible citizen within an information society, which, what, again, sorry to get on my soapbox, but watching this in the year 2025 is fucking trip. I'm
such
like,
an
yo,
interesting swerve. Maybe
I need to like clip this whole like speech that she does out of context and just like share it onto Blue Sky, because like I feel like more people need to hear what she's saying.
What she says is really like, good.
It's like you thought you were following clues, but you were really just following a map somebody else drew for you. Like,
yes.
Just over and over, kind of like like in her very professional way, she's just decimating their what they thought they discovered.
Dressing them down in the most professional, polite way possible. Not dressing them down, but more of like pointing to what the fuck is actually going on here.
And also, because there's a little detail, in addition to being like, oh, Mr. Jin didn't exist, but also Noah and Izumi, or Asuma, they were thinking that the young girl in the shop turned out to be the sister, the younger sister of the one who died. So we believed her when she told us some other things about what's going on here. And then Clancy turns around and says, actually, she's not the sister. She's one and the same.
Yep.
Yes. So we learned that the girl who was the ghost was, in fact, the ghost. The living girl that they saw that looked like the ghost was not a sister, which, yeah, that's a really important detail, is that they are told that the reason there's a resemblance between this ghost and this girl is because they were siblings. But yeah, we learned that was bullshit. It was one person. And the girl, you know, Goto's like, hey, that's really good reasoning. But again, that's all circumstantial evidence.
Until...
And then the girl comes out and is like, nah, I couldn't keep lying. Sorry, guys.
Sorry, uncle. Yeah, it's his niece. And then like Goto just like stands up real stern and he bows and he's like, forgive me. And they just throw so shit at him. Yeah.
It was really funny. I don't know, in the like subtitle, he just says sorry, but he just says it. He just gets up and you think he's going to say a big thing about like the lesson they've all learned. And he just says, sorry. Just like sorry. Just quiet and fast.
And then just thermoses and, then, like, and cups and shit all hit him in the face.
A fraction of a second later, a bunch of stuff is thrown at him. And then his niece runs in front of the detritus and goes, don't shoot. No.
and that's the end of our episode.
It's very wacky, but I loved it.
One thing I forgot to mention is that even after Kanuko Clancy finishes her absolute evisceration of their theory of what happened, she says, I do think the point of this was to remind us of the dangers of how we use weapons and how we apply violence.
But
so
Goto,
she does agree with him there. Yeah.
Yeah, but Goto, I have to disagree with your methods.
Yeah.
Yes. So very fun episode. Again, them doing their own thing within the mecha space, right?
Yeah.
It's so far we have had our first episode was sort of a straightforward police procedure, like a extremely grounded police procedural with some funny stuff going on in it. Mostly putting the piece on the second board. The second piece was a bit more of the same. And then we've had a kaiju episode and a ghost episode.
Yes.
So excited to see the fifth episode.
The fifth episode is actually a two-parter. It's a fifth.
Ooh.
The fifth and the sixth episode are a two-parter. So we might have to figure out what we're going to do for those two episodes. If we're going to do it individually. Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, I'm open to both or individually, but I'm curious about not making the final two the two-parter.
Yeah.
But there's definitely been this through line. And I think maybe the third episode of the kaiju didn't have as much of this, but this almost like it's satirizing this mecha genre. And the second one did that a lot in some specific ways. This one was interesting for how it was actually bringing in the idea that like they exist in a world where giant mecha media exists.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you actually get that not infrequently with Gundam. I mean, War in the Pocket. It's what's interesting there is, or I want to say, they try to talk about things like fandom or this idea of like, is it bad to think like the villain robots are cool? There's some stuff like that that gets a little bit of a like discussion or themes in some Gundam. But I don't think there's just like, I was watching, you know, War in the Pocket the other night, and it made me really think about what we do here at the Gundam Factory. Like, that's not something you directly get in that you do here, where he actually just dresses it down and is like, what do you think, you're in a mecha cartoon? Like, come on.
Right.
But I really enjoyed the horror theme of this episode, and that is a slight transition. And that is a bit of a transition to our labor topic of the week, and I'm gonna play you a song.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe. I didn't die.
So this is Paul Robeson, American communist footballer.
Oh, wow.
All around cool guy. Yeah, this is a Paul Robeson is a fun Wikipedia read. And also, I probably should read a real book around about him at some point. But the song he's singing is sort of a love song from one labor activist to another, because he's singing about Joe Hill. And the song is more or less about a confrontation with Joe Hill's ghost. How I do some of my research for the show and figuring labor topics is I just Google shit. I just Google keywords and then I poke around and sometimes I find something interesting. And this week's find is this really, really good piece in from Protean Magazine called The Haunted Houses of Labor. I will link this to you, Clayton, so we can put it in the show notes. People can also look it up. And I'll just read a little bit from this. This is by Kim Kelly in 2023, published on Halloween. The House of Labor, much like damn near any other historical dwelling on the U.S. soil, is built atop a burial ground. The blood and bones of indigenous people and African captives form its foundation, and every layer built on top of it adds another new industry, another new kind of oppression, and another generation of suffering. By the time you get to the floorboards, there are already centuries of workers' pain worn into the wood, the tears of the mill girls, the sweat of farm workers, the domestics' sore backs, the auto workers' bloody hands, the coal miners' heaving breaths, and so many more. Their spirits suffuse our shared history, and their sacrifices have continued to fuel this moment since its earliest stirring. Of course, the House of Labor is haunted. Every step we've taken together has come at a heavy cost, and every march towards victory has wound past a graveyard. The framing of this piece sort of starts ghost story-y, a little Halloween-y, a little scary.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of it plays out as more or less a summary of a lot of instances. It's a really wonderfully taught summary of a lot of instances of people dying for the labor movement. And these being the ghosts that haunt positively and negatively labor in America. We hear about Joe Hill, who is the man sung about in the song Joe Hill, who is a Swedish American laborer who learned English in the early 1900s and then went on to become a cartoonist and songwriter who wrote a lot of the most enduring labor songs that like we still have. He wrote Rebel Girl. He wrote There's Power in the Union, The Preacher and the Slave. And he also coined the phrase pie in the sky.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah. But he was picked up on a pretty flimsy murder charge and shot to death by an execution squad.
Wow.
And, you know, people debate whether that was conveniently picking up a guy who the copper bosses, as Paul Robeson sings, wanted to get rid of because he was labor organizing in that area, or whether it was he had legitimately shot somebody. We don't know. We hear about Franny Sellens, who struck with hotel workers and was killed for her efforts. We hear about a lot of the stuff that happened to mining families over the centuries that they have been fighting for, not the centuries, but in the century that they were fighting for recognition. Yeah, it's a very good article, and I really, really appreciate the way it jumps through history and ties together the stories of these people who, some willingly, some unwillingly, became ghosts of the labor movement.
She's a really good writer. Kim Kelly is a really good writer, by the way. Like, Fight Like Hell is a good book. I would definitely recommend that, yeah.
Oh, have you read that?
Yes. Yeah, it's good.
Shit,
it's good.
Man, nice. I need to read more.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly,
but yeah, it's, that's my find.
Or it's not clearly. I think it's a thing that is often overlooked with unions and this whole, you know, modern decline in unions when it used to be much higher, is that a phrase with some of the things being undone there and why that's happening. This is also applies to regulations, is that like those union laws were paved with blood. Those regulations were paved with blood. Like there is a reason, and you could even say this is not just about like, there's a lot of death from the workers, the most of it.
Absolutely.
Bosses died too.
Yeah.
And it seems like that side of it has been forgotten a little bit, that like this was for peace. This was the armistice.
Right.
And if those treaties start to be like ignored, then violence will return. It's that was what it was there for. And so it's kind of for everyone's benefit that we remember how many people died for the cause of labor.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I thought it was a fun on-theme piece and definitely worth a read.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to link that.
Yeah.
I also tried looking to see if I was like, are there any dinner theater unions? I couldn't find any. Because this whole episode reminded me of like, you know, a big dinner theater episode.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I wonder if
they're all sent to like a remote place. It's kind of like a murder mystery setup.
Yeah. Are there murder mystery unions? Like where people like act out like a murder mystery, and I'm just like, oh yeah, all these actors are unionized. And I'm just like, I would hope so. Yeah.
The guy getting up off the floor to take his mandated 15-minute break, the dead guy like, oh, yes. Sorry, yes. I'll be back.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I know at least, and this is only my experience on making one horror film, but I feel very good about the fact that our special effects guy was extremely knowledgeable about, or extremely caring about the people he was putting in a big rubber mask. And he felt extremely important about certain things, about how long they got, how long they had to be in it, how many shoots we had to do with them in the suit. He was also just like 100% against doing contacts, because he just felt that is never worth the numerous kinds of problems you can have putting contacts in people who don't normally wear them.
Right.
And this extends to some discussions we've also just had about the entertainment industry, but like there are things that don't seem dangerous because of the work put in to make them that way, like special effects and stunts.
Right.
It didn't used to be as safe as it is, and it's still dangerous, but that's because of the cost of lives and blood that got it to that point.
Yeah.
I mean, the classic thing that like dads complain about when you drive past a construction site and there's just a, you know, two people standing there and one person working. And they're like, look at that. There's all that wasted money. It's like, oh, no, those people are there for a reason, right?
Yeah,
like,
because exactly.
How this situation could change if somebody isn't there, right? Like,
right.
You don't have somebody to catch you when you fall off the ladder, or your arm gets stuck in the thing you're using and nobody's there to pull you out. Like, but I really liked this episode of Pat Labor, and I want to watch more Pat Labor.
Me too.
It's very hard to not let the DVD keep going to the next one.
I know. Yeah.
I think I just want to pitch this, that we'll be approaching here, I guess, the last three episodes. So it won't be too long before we complete this season. And I think maybe we'll try to do a little bonus ep, sort of like a reflection on the first OVA of Pat Labor, because then we're going to move to the movies. And that's so interesting to me, is that like, I still keep thinking like, oh yeah, we're going to hold off the movies because they're not as relevant. But this story we're building is going to amount to like literally those movies. Like that's the next thing. And that's also like making me really excited to keep going.
Yeah. Very excited to watch the movies, because the movies are so gorgeous too.
Yes,
holy cow.
And the leap between like Pat Labor 1 and Pat Labor 2 is just absolutely remarkable. Like almost unbelievable. It was just like, how? It's like, They somehow managed to switch up the entire aesthetic of Pat Labor between Pat Labor 1 and Pat Labor 2, and yet it feels like a natural continuation in a way. Yeah.
But yeah, that's Pat Labor 4, The Tragedy of L, is that what it was called?
Yep. And we're not talking about the detective from Death Note. No, we're not talking about
that involved here. Even though we did do detective stuff, no Death Note stuff here.
Yes.
And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with the fifth episode, which will be part one of a part two episode of Pat Labor.
Yes.
If you're watching along in the show, this show, you can find it on DVD, Blu-ray, some places. So far, I've been watching the dub on YouTube, and that's been working out great for me. So again, if you're listening and you would like to watch along, just punch it into YouTube and you'll find it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we appreciate all of our readers and subscribers over at rogue.site. Keep checking that out. I know we just had a bunch of stuff. This is not going to be relevant now that I'm recording it, but I know just a ton of stuff for Hades 2 is coming out. And so we got you there. There was also just a reminder that we have another podcast at Rogue Site where the crew of writers talks about video game news and what they're playing that week. So check that out, too. This has been Pat's Labor. I am Clayton.
I'm Tucson Egan.
I'm Pat Labor.
And if you're not sticking around for the video podcast, bye.
Bye, everybody.